Last Sunday, as I was leaving church out at Mount Zion, I found myself in a conversation and disagreeing with someone about a hot-button topic that we've not seen eye-to-eye with, or eye-to-eye on, for a while now. They're patiently trying to persuade me to their way of thinking, and I'm patiently explaining why that is not likely to happen. We agreed to disagree and parted with a hug. We're not likely to change our minds and agree with each other about this subject. But the most important thing is that it does not impact our relationship in a negative way, and on that, we do agree. Now that may be a somewhat lighthearted example, but sometimes being at peace with others seems like a very hard thing to do. Personally, we disagree with others on a whole myriad of issues, of which politics seems to be the popular one right now. These disagreements, whatever they are about, can often lead to bigger problems, such as full-blown quarrels and arguments, and sometimes even dissolutions of old friendships and relationships. We hold to our belief that we are right and to our point of view, no matter the cost. There's a line from an old Donna Fargo song. Yes, I'm dating myself, but we grew up listening to Lennon Vince's old country records. As a kid, I thought this line, "Sometimes right is just as wrong as wrong," was one of the dumbest things I had ever heard. Why wouldn't we want to be right about something? That didn't make sense to me. But somewhere along the line, with more wisdom, I get it. If being right comes at the expense of causing damage to a relationship, is it worth it? On a very few items, it may be. But on most things, it probably isn't. And if we don't see eye to eye about certain subjects, maybe we should just avoid bringing up those issues if possible. Our New Testament lessons are just a couple of the many passages in the Bible that provide guidance on how we should treat others. In his letter to the Romans, Paul is addressing the weak and strong in regards to their faith and their faith practices. Many Jewish followers of Christ still follow the Jewish practices, such as dietary guidelines and observance of the Jewish holy days. Whereas other new believers, especially among the Gentiles, did not adhere to these practices. Whether one held Jewish holy days to be special, or whether one lives every day with the same dedication to God, was not supposed to be a point of contention among the other. And it was the same with dietary practices. One was to respect the other's belief, and both were to serve the Lord and thank him for his provision. If we are followers of Christ, we are not to live to please ourselves, but to please the Lord. Even at death, the important thing is truly our relationship with the Lord. Because of his death and resurrection, Jesus is Lord of the living and the dead. We are told not to judge others because of their beliefs, and eventually we will all have to give an account of ourselves. In the passage from Paul's letter to the Colossians, he lays out rules for holy living, which we should all aspire to. Yes, Israel was God's chosen people, but so too is the Christian community of which we are a part. And if we are living our lives practicing or clothed in those virtues, compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, we will find it much easier to be at peace with others. Last week I mentioned about a sermon from Reverend Charles Stanley in which he talked about patience. Two points he made were that patience is vital to a good relationship, and patience is essential to settling disputes. Bearing with each other and forgiving grievances requires patience and compassion. We are not asked to always agree about everything, but to let love bind us together in unity. We are to let the peace of Christ rule in our hearts and thereby in all of our relationships. If you remember from last week, this is the peace that Christ promised his disciples. It is not peace as the world gives. The world only gives the hope or the wishful thinking for peace. And if we somehow think that we have peace from the world, it's often only transitory. The peace Christ gives is real and present and will last. Jesus, in his Sermon on the Mount from Matthew, actually gives a much stronger wording, I guess, much stronger instruction as far as judging others and forgiving others than what Paul gives in these letters. While the two passages from Paul's letters instruct us in how to deal with others, the lesson from Mark's gospel is more about having inner peace or being at peace with yourself. In this lesson, Jesus told his disciples that he wanted to go to the other side of the lake. He wanted to go from the region of Galilee to the region, to the other side of the lake, which was the region of the Gerasenes. This severe storm comes up. Severe weather on the Sea of Galilee was not uncommon. The lake is 700 feet below sea level. It's 13 miles long and 8 miles wide and surrounded by mountains or high areas. And when wind brings cool air from the Mediterranean, it can quickly stir up violent storms when it meets the warm, humid air above the lake or over the lake. Now, Jesus had been teaching all day, and he was exhausted. Mark emphasizes the fully human side of Jesus when he says that he was in the stern asleep on a cushion. We can all picture ourselves exhausted and falling asleep even in a less than ideal resting spot. This must have been an especially bad storm. As you know, many of the disciples were fishermen and had surely been on rough waters before. But they were scared to the point of thinking they were going to drown. In desperation, they awakened Jesus, and he calms the storm. In a few short verses, we see a Jesus with fully human attributes to a Jesus with fully divine attributes. Not only is Jesus Lord of his church or his followers, he is also Lord of all creation. And this terrifies the disciples when he performs this miracle. Fear and worry can keep us from having inner peace, but so too can many other things. I want to share a story that illustrates this. How many of you know who Russ Taff is? You know, he's a well-known gospel singer. Russ was born in Farmersville, California. He was the fourth of five boys. His father was a Pentecostal minister and raised the boys in a very strict household. The only entertainment allowed was some old gospel records of their mothers. And his father's preaching was the old hellfire and brimstone that scared more than invited one to faith. What almost no one knew was that his father was also an abusive alcoholic. His father would preach on a Sunday morning, go visit the sick, and then disappear for days at a time. After a few days, the mother would send the boys to go look for their father. They would often find him passed out in his truck. When his father would come home, Russ would put his younger brother between himself and the wall because he didn't know what his father was going to do. Russ was 9 when he spent the night at a friend's house. And he told his friend, through the course of the evening, told his friend that his parents had had an argument. When Russ came home, his mother yelled at him and said that what happened at home was not to be told to anyone. She then began pummeling him with her fists. When he fell down, she began kicking him. He wore a long-sleeve shirt to school for 2 weeks to hide the bruises. When Russ was 11, his mother would come in his room and tell him all her problems. She would complain about his father, how he didn't provide for them, how she didn't know if she could make it to the end of the month and pay the bills. When Russ said that he wished she would just leave him, his mother backhanded him, splitting his lip open. Throughout this abusive childhood, Russ would find solace in music. He sang his first solo in church when he was 3, and he learned to play the guitar. When Russ was 13, his family moved halfway across the country and lived with his grandfather in Arkansas because they had no money. Again, active in church, he started a band with some other boys from the church. They invited kids from school to come to the church and hear the band. Many did and would come down for the altar call. There were also kids who would ask Russ about Jesus at school, and Russ would explain and then pray with them. The band stayed together and once played as the opening act for the legendary Imperials. When the Imperial singer left the group, this is 2 years later, they remembered this young man with a distinctive voice and invited Russ to join them. Russ stayed with them for a few years, gaining national recognition before embarking on a solo career. His first solo album won a Grammy, and his career took off. He was playing at sold-out venues, and he was winning awards, Dove Awards, which is gospel music, and Grammy Awards. But despite all this success, he felt empty inside and began drinking. He also felt guilty. He was singing about God, but then he would go to his room and drink. Like many alcoholics, he hid the drinking from his wife, from his bandmates, pretty much from everybody. He never performed inebriated on stage. After a while, he did tell his wife. At first, she didn't believe him. She had never seen him drink, never saw him drunk, and she never smelled it on him. When she realized it was true, she became upset because she knew his family history, but she didn't know how to stop it. After a while, his solo career began tapering off, and he would join another well-known gospel group, the Gaither Vocal Band. He still hid the drinking. His wife would eventually organize an intervention, and he would enter treatment. Russ stayed sober for years and then relapsed when his father passed away. Following treatment again, he stayed sober for years, but relapsed after his mother passed away. This time, he would show up drunk at a taping of with a live audience. It wasn't a live show. He showed up drunk, and it was an ensemble performance. There were multiple gospel artists there. The producer's wife would drive him and his 2 daughters home. His wife, Tori, was livid. This time, he had involved their 2 girls in it. After pushing him into their bedroom, she angrily grabbed the car keys from him. He had keys to another car in the room. He crawled out a window and took the other vehicle. As he was driving, which he obviously shouldn't have been, he thought about ending it all. And Tori made up her mind that she was done with their marriage no matter what he did. Despite extraordinary success, this gospel singer was in danger of losing it all. His career, his wife, and his kids. He had sung for decades about God's grace, but he couldn't feel that grace himself. He still felt like the abused little boy who wasn't good enough. And after all these years of using his music to help draw people to God, he hadn't been able to find peace himself. He entered a different treatment center this time. During individual counseling, this went on for about 3 weeks, Russ would literally end up crying in a fetal position on the floor as they would explore his childhood and the extent of the abuse. When he finished the treatment, he went to stay at his friend Mark Lowry's place. And while staying there, Mark's minister asked if Russ would come visit his father in the hospital. The minister's father was sick, who was dying, and he was a big fan of Russ's. Russ agreed to go. When he entered the hospital room, Russ stopped dead in his tracks. The minister's father looked exactly like Russ's own abusive father, physical appearance. Russ sang and they talked a while. The man, Franklin James, asked Russ to pray for him, and Russ did. When Russ went to leave, he found himself turning and asking Mr. Jones to pray for him. Mr. Jones struggled to his feet and placed his hands on Russ. He prayed for him, thanking God for the gift that had been given to Russ and that Russ had used it to the glory of God. Russ finally felt the affirmation he so desperately needed from this man who looked eerily similar to his own abusive father. Despite her resolve to end their marriage, Tori literally saw the change in Russ when he returned home. This is about 2.5 months later. He was gone for that long between treatment and staying at his friend's house. When he returned home, and she asked him what had happened, they stayed together. Russ has not suffered a relapse since. He still attends monthly meetings. They decided to share their story so that maybe it would help others. If anybody, I don't know how many of you have access to YouTube, go to, I think it's Crown TV, and type it, it's Russ Taff, I Still Believe. That's the documentary of their story, if you're interested in looking at that. Whether we're scared, or whether we're worried, or whether we have hurts so deep that we can't move past them, God's grace can and does overcome all obstacles to give us inner peace.